recurring topic on The Evolving Leader is how to grow and innovate, particularly in an uncertain and conflicted environment. Innovation is problematic for established companies because their group norms, processes, and priorities are often precisely the opposite of what challenging the status quo involves. In this show, we look at research by Professor John Mullins and the rules that innovators need to break in the corporate environment to succeed. He describes these rules as six counterculture mindsets and gives us practical examples of them in action. If you need to challenge the status quo, there's a lot in here to digest.
Hey folks, welcome to the Evolving Leader Podcast. I'm Scott Allender.
And I'm John Gomes.
How are you feeling today, Mr. Gomes?
I am feeling full of the joys of spring. It's starting to get lighter and there's a few signs of life in the world. So yeah, no, I'm feeling pretty good because of that. How are you feeling?
I feel similar. It's been quite warm and pleasant. Pollen is starting to take effect here in Tennessee, so there's always the double-edged sword with allergies that start to flare up, but all in all, very positive because I love when the days get longer and everything gets warmer and starts to bloom. So super excited and very happy to be here today again with you and our guest, because today we are joined by John Mullins. John is a best-selling author, an internationally recognized thought leader for anyone who seeks to grow their business faster. He's a veteran of three entrepreneurial ventures and a professor of management practice at London Business School. He's published four books, not including his textbooks, each of which has become the go-to source on the stage of entrepreneurial journeys. So his most recent book is called Break the Rules, The Six Counter-Conventional Mindsets of Entrepreneurs. And we are always interested in discussing mindsets on the show, and we are delighted you're here, John. Welcome to The Evolving Leader.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, John. Great to be here.
Welcome to the show, John. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling fired up. I'm looking forward to talking to you guys because not everybody thinks about mindsets a lot.
Yeah, we certainly do. We spend a lot of time talking about it. So let's get to know you a little bit personally, a bit before we dive into your work. Beyond your professional biography, can you share a bit about your background and personal interests?
Yeah, my background is that I grew up in New Jersey, just outside New York City, where my dad worked, lived in various places around the U.S. over the years, moved to London for what I thought was going to be 10 weeks in 2000 for a short sabbatical, and that 10 weeks turned out to be a little longer stay, right? I'm now at London Business School more than 20 years, so it's been fantastic. My interests, aside from my work, include anything outdoors. So I play tennis, I ski. I recently completed hiking the Colorado Trail, which is a 485-mile trail across the mountains in Colorado.
Wow.
Stuff like that.
Wow. I'm a bit envious of your landing in London. I love that city. I wouldn't mind having
Wonderful
20 years
city.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah. As I mentioned in the intro, you are the veteran of three different entrepreneurial ventures. Tell us about those. What were they and what compelled you to start each of them?
Well, I didn't start the first one. I joined the first one. First one, I'd been working at a large retail firm in Chicago after my MBA, a big supermarket business called Jewel. And one of my MBA classmates had also entered the retailing industry with Dayton Hudson in Minneapolis, and then had been recruited to join a small company on the West Coast called The Gap. Jack was the senior operating guy, and Jack was looking for a talent who knew something about retailing, and one thing led to another, and I headed to the West Coast and joined Gap when it was relatively small. I think we had about 100 stores on the day I met Jack to talk about coming to the Gap. And it was quite clear at the time that Gap was going to be in a foot race with another retailer called County Seat, which is now more or less long gone. But where you get your location in a shopping mall matters a lot. And Jack and the operating team had realized that it was going to be a foot race to win those good shopping mall locations. And so we had to step on the pedal. So I joined Gap and ran stores and groups of stores, and I ran loss prevention for a while, and we grew Gap in the next 3 or 4 years from 100 to 400 stores, which in a people-intensive business is no small challenge. And that's where I learned the great joy of growing a business. It's just it's just great fun. And by the time we got to 400 stores, Gap was feeling a little less entrepreneurial. You know, you had to put in systems and processes and make sure everything was done right. And I said, you know, I've learned some things here. I could maybe go do something on my own. So a friend and I started a little business that we then ran for, I think 12 years, selling a device called a charcoal starter. Back in those days, one would barbecue with charcoal, not with gas. And this little metal cylinder would enable you to light the charcoal without any of that stinky lighter fluid and light it much more reliably and faster. But that was just sort of a little side business. And then a few years later, I started a business with some friends to do what we hoped would be for the fresh pasta category, what Häagen-Dazs had done for ice cream. So we began to build a chain of stores in Denver, then opened stores in Chicago. But technology came along and killed us. These days, when we buy fresh pasta, we buy it in the grocery store, and it's a little package that contains two things. It contains fresh pasta, but it also is filled with nitrogen gas, which means the so-called fresh pasta can't grow any mold. So that was a failure. So by the time I'd been in this in and around these retailing businesses for 20 years, I don't know if you guys know anybody in retailing, but 20 years in retailing is enough. It's a tough industry. And so I said, time to do something else. And after some introspection and a little career coaching and thinking about what should be next, I decided I wanted to be a business school professor. So I left the retailing world and here I am.
Well, I have a lot of questions, and I can see your energy and your passion around this, and I want to get into more of the reasons why this kind of work is so fun for you. But just in case anybody's listening that is not an entrepreneur, we have leaders all around the globe in various roles who are listening right now. And so before we dive any deeper into your work and what you teach and all of that, so that we don't potentially lose anyone, because I want them to hear everything you're about to say, can you set the stage from the start on how your body of work applies to everyone, not just the archetypical entrepreneurial role of a startup or a scale-up?
Scott. I've written four books, as you remarked, and each of them I wrote because there was a particular challenge in the entrepreneurial world that I thought needed a solution, and for which I thought a book was the right solution. And each of those, the books apply to varying degrees to people in settings other than entrepreneurial settings. So my first book, and still the one that sold the most copies, is The New Business Road Test. And I wrote that book because nobody around the time I wrote it, which was, you know, the turn of the century when the dot-com bust was happening, and there'd been all these crazy dot-com ventures, and it wasn't clear that anybody had a good way to assess an idea and say, is this actually really a good business that I'm about to start here? So I wrote that book to do that. And of course, every company has to do that. Every business person, when they do something new, has to say, is this a good opportunity? And so while that book has sold primarily to entrepreneurs and investors who back them, I find that it's used as well by anybody who's thinking about new products in a big company, And even people who are thinking about M&A in big companies, you know, is this a good opportunity? So that's how that one fits. Getting to Plan B is a book about business models, and many companies have great business models. Many companies have terrible business models that consume a lot of cash. And again, having a rigorous way to think about one's business model and the elements therein to figure out if it can grow, which is something that virtually every company wants to do, is a timeless issue. So I think that one fits as well. The customer-funded business is about sort of breaking the mindset that the entrepreneurial ecosystem has had for quite some time, that sort of the VC Kool-Aid, I call it, where everybody thinks what you have to do to start a new business is to come up with a great idea, write a great pitch deck, raise some money, and voila, you're going to be rich in a couple of weeks. You know, that's not how it works. And most businesses get funded by their customers, and the best businesses get funded by their customers. And again, that's something that's universal. It doesn't have to be done just by entrepreneurs.
Yeah, but that's super helpful.
Scott, I know we're going to talk about Break the Rules, my newest book. This is a book that I've written explicitly for a wider audience, whereas the first three apply, but I didn't write them for that audience. This one I wrote for everybody.
So can we go back to the new business road test for a moment, and perhaps some of the others as well, in terms of, you know, the myths that sit in the head of would-be entrepreneurs, people have got ideas. And the fact that they tend to repeat the mistakes of previous entrepreneurs a lot, and I think, you know, when people look at things like the Lean Startup, they think there's a playbook out there that's fairly clear and easy to understand until they start to do it. What have you seen? What advice if you were talking to a young entrepreneur now? What advice would you give them? To avoid some of those first fails?
I think the biggest advice I'd give, John, is what Vinod Khosla says. He's a well-known venture capital investor in California. And he says, find a big problem. And when you find a big problem and you can solve that big problem, you have a big opportunity. And what he says is nobody will pay you to solve a non-problem. Too many entrepreneurs don't think about it from a problem-focused point of view. They think about an idea or a product. You know, I want to be an entrepreneur. I need an idea. No, you don't need an idea. What you need is a problem that some customer has, some group of customers, and then you figure out if you can solve that problem, you and your team. It's a team sport, not a solo sport. That's the other mistake people make. They say, oh, I'm just going to go it alone and do this. But rarely does a really successful business get that way because it's just one person. It's a team with complementary skills. So I think the two biggest mistakes I see are going it alone rather than building a team with complementary skills, and thinking too much about ideas or products or services you can offer as opposed to thinking about customers and the problems they have.
Given what you learned in the 20 years and subsequently in terms of reflecting and your research and your teachings, if you could go back to your, I don't know, 25-year-old self and give yourself a talking to, what would you say?
Well, sometimes I think about that, you know, and if I were to go back to Pasta Villa, the business we built in the fresh pasta category that ultimately failed, I think a key mistake we made there is that we were very clear in our vision that we wanted to build a retailing business. I'd been a retailer. I assembled a board and a group of investors who also thought it appropriate to build a retailing business and wanted to do that. And that left us sort of boxed into a retailing mindset. And when technology changed our little world and made a different kind of product possible, a gas-flushed, you know, package of fresh pasta, we weren't well-equipped people-wise to A, see that change, B, understand its magnitude, and C, react to it. So I think I learned that you need to have people around you that may not have perspectives that are directly relevant to what you're trying to do today, but might be very helpful in thinking about what we might have to do tomorrow.
Mm.
So that was a big lesson for me.
And do you think, because this idea of the entrepreneur who's very passionate about their product and their idea can sometimes get quite defensive about it as well when they hear disruptive or counter arguments to it. Tell us a little bit about what you think you've learned around the ability to hear differing perspectives as well.
Well, you know, entrepreneurship is a difficult game to play. It's inherently highly uncertain because when you're doing something new, you think you've found a customer problem, maybe, but you don't maybe fully understand it. You might be right. You might not be right about it. And so entrepreneurship requires, in my view, a combination of tenacity to stay the course and say, yeah, I believe I'm on the right path here. That's on one hand. With, on the other hand, the flexibility to say, you know, I've been trying to beat my way through this brick wall. Maybe I should go around it. And that's really difficult to, you know, it's an ambidextrous kind of thing. It's really difficult to have hold both of those notions in your mind at the same time.
Mm.
And one never knows at a given moment in time, is this the time to go around the brick wall, or is this the time that one more shot at the wall may break me through?
Yeah. So let's move to your latest book, which I read last weekend, really enjoyed. Can you give us the pitch and why you wrote it?
Yeah, I wrote it. My wife Donna says I wrote it because I needed a project, and there might be a little bit of truth in that. But the real reason I wrote it is that we know that entrepreneurs leading fast-growing businesses create virtually all of the world's net new jobs. Those net new jobs are not created by startups, because for every startup that's coming into existence, there's another one down the road that's failing. And they're not created by big companies, because these days, big companies are working very hard to replace labor with capital. And so they're taking jobs out of the economy. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. So what we need in the world, if we're going to put all these people to work and bring Africa and other parts of the world that really need development, what we need is more entrepreneurial thinking across the board, not just in new companies, but in companies that exist that would have the potential to grow if the circumstances were right. As well as in big companies that could grow faster, perhaps, if their people were a bit more entrepreneurial and not stuck in the old ways. So I said to myself, how do we get the world to think a little more, the business world, to think a little bit more entrepreneurially? And so what I was sort of reflecting on my body of work. I've developed more than 50 case studies, and I've had a ringside seat into what makes entrepreneurs tick. And I said, well, I wonder if I could go back and look at that body of research and see if I can discover the difference between entrepreneurs, successful entrepreneurs, and other successful business people. And way back, sort of going back to when I made my career change, there was a bunch of research that was done by the academic community when entrepreneurs began to get onto the academic radar to try and figure out what the differences were between entrepreneurs and other business people, other successful business people. And the sum total of that research is that we can't find any differences. You know, for every brash extrovert like Stelios in the UK or Richard Branson or Elon Musk, there's an introvert like Michael Dell, for every PhD building a great high-tech business, there's an immigrant who gets off the boat, a guy like Hamdi Ukalaya in the U.S. who built this great yogurt brand, Chobani. So nobody could find those differences. And yet I know in my heart that there are fundamental differences. And I said, well, that'd be an interesting challenge for me to take on. Can I figure out what those differences are? So I look back at my body of work, and what I discovered is that the differences are in their mindsets. Now, you guys work on mindsets too. And for me, a mindset is the mental stuff up here, the habits and dispositions that we have that cause us, when we encounter something in our environment, to respond in a certain way. That's what a mindset is. It connects what we see with what we do. And I discovered that there are six mindsets of these successful entrepreneurs that cause entrepreneurs to react to what comes their way, opportunities, as we call them in the entrepreneurship world, that causes them to react differently than other business people would. And so I said these six mindsets need to see the light of day because A, they are learnable. B, they can be applied by anyone, I think, who chooses to apply them. Not everybody wants to be an entrepreneur. Not everybody wants to deal or live in this life of uncertainty that entrepreneurs live in. But for those who do, these mindsets are in some sense a toolkit for overcoming obstacles, for challenging assumptions, for mitigating risks. So I said, this work needs a book, and now we have a book.
So let's talk through those mindsets. So let's start with Yes, We Can, which you illustrate with Amazon's initial breakthroughs. How does this change conventional thinking?
Well, the convention. Let's start with the conventional thinking, Scott. The conventional thinking for 40 or 50 years now in big business is that one should stick to one's knitting. That means you identify the core competencies of the business you're in, and you build on those, you nurture them, you invest in them, you try and make them more robust. But when some customer asks you to do something different than those, you're supposed to say no. No, we don't do that. We stick to our knitting. But entrepreneurs don't do that. Good ones don't. So when somebody, some customer comes along and says, I have a problem here, could you solve it for me? The entrepreneur goes, yeah, we can do that. Yes, we can. And then they have to go back to their office or garage or whatever and say, holy cow, how the hell am I going to deliver on this? And that's just fundamentally different, you know, than we've taught in big businesses how to respond to those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And you know, Kindle is a great example. You know, Jeff Bezos realized that his physical book and music distribution business was about to get disrupted digitally, and competitive advantage was going to go away because they weren't going to have to ship anything anymore. You know, they didn't need warehouses for books and music. This is before it became the everything store. And he said, we're going to have to build a hardware product. How the hell are we going to do that? We don't know anything about hardware. But they did. And the Kindle, I would argue, dragged publishers kicking and screaming into the 21st century. Mm-hmm.
That's really helpful and good illustration. So next you have problem first, not product first logic. And we had a previous guest on the show, Dan Olson, whose work on the product market fit model taught us how difficult it is to get product and marketing people to think about the customer problem first. So what have you learned about how those who succeed in this respect think and act differently?
Well, I think the fundamental difference is that some business people, some marketers, know and understand that it's all about the customer. Peter Drucker, the great management thinker mm-hmm. of the 20th century, said, if you don't have a customer, you don't have a business. That's really a pretty simple idea. Somebody's got to pay, and if you don't have a customer who's willing to pay, you don't have a business. But for some reason, most companies get in love with their products, and they forget to think about the customer. But it's really about the customer, and the way most successful entrepreneurial ventures start, not all of them, but most of them get started because they find a customer problem to solve. And I tell the story in the book about Nike's origins. We can tell that story here if you like. But that's just a completely different mindset than, say, Tide. You know, my family and I have been using Tide detergent for a long time, and we can always tell when there's a new brand manager on Tide because they change the product. They put blue speckles in, and they call it new improved. Then they change the scent and call it Mountain Fresh, and the next guy does that, and it's new improved. And now they have water in it, so you can pour it. And it's new, improved. Come on, is this innovation? This isn't really innovation, guys.
It's repackaging.
You know, that's the difference, Scott.
Yeah. You mentioned Nike. Tell us about Nike.
Yeah. So, Phil Knight was in business school at Stanford a long time ago, and was a runner. He was a very good runner. He could run almost, but not quite, a 4-minute mile. And his track coach was a guy at the University of Oregon before B school, was a guy named Bill Bowerman. And Bowerman was kind of an inveterate tinkerer. He was always fiddling around with shoes and gear and stuff. And the two of them realized that the shoes that elite distance runners wore were the wrong shoes. So the shoes were coming mostly from Germany in those days. And they were made for sprinters. And sprinters trained by running around a track, a nice smooth surface. Distance runners don't train on a track. They train on dirt roads and country paths. And they're always stepping on rocks and sticks. And so they get a lot of sprained ankles. They run many more miles than sprinters do. And so they tend to get shin splints. So Knight and Bowerman thought a little more cushioning in the shoe would be helpful to prevent those injuries. And they said, and while we're at it, wouldn't it be nice if the shoe were a little lighter weight? Because if you take a couple ounces out of the shoe times all the steps involved in running a marathon, maybe that'll lead to faster race times. Well, can we build a shoe that's good for elite distance runners? Well, they were solving problems there. That's what they set out to do, right? And of course, once they learned how to design shoes, how to get athletes to help them design shoes, how to source those shoes in Asia, how to get athletes to endorse those shoes, they had built a set of competencies that they could then apply to other categories. So once Nike athletes began winning medals, everybody wanted to wear Nikes, everybody who was a serious runner. And so, you know, it spread outside elite runners. And then they took these skills they'd learned and said, well, gee, let's talk to John McEnroe and let's do tennis. Let's talk to Michael Jordan and let's do basketball. And off they went. But all driven by two things, really. Number one, focusing on the problem, but secondly, focusing on a tiny, tiny market segment, which is, you know, the next of the six mindsets, which is think narrowly, not broadly. You know, if there were ever a contest for the smallest target market ever, elite distance runners might win that contest. You know, how many 4-minute milers are there in the country or in the world?
And that bit is very counterintuitive in terms of, you know, thinking about a narrow, because when you look at most marketing people and product people having conversations, they're trying to talk about addressable markets and making a justification for,
and bigger is better is their assumption, right?
Well, they're not going to get the investment from their leaders in the business unless they can prove that there is X hundreds of millions of dollars, pounds, and that they can get 10% of that market within a certain period of time. So tell us a little bit more about this, because this really is a heart of a convention that dogs a lot of innovation efforts.
Yeah. Well, the reason the thinking narrowly, not broadly, makes sense is if you can narrow down a target market to a very small group that's homogeneous, that they're all pretty much the same and have the same problems or needs. Like elite distance runners are different than the rest of the running world in their needs. If you can narrow down to that, then you have a chance to build something that fits precisely what those needs are. Whereas if you're trying to serve a more heterogeneous market, you can't do that as effectively. And so that's how you get a great start. Now, that isn't the end game for entrepreneurs. They know that's not the end game, but they don't worry so much about the end game. They say, well, we've identified this group of customers. They've got a problem. We think we can solve that problem, as in the Nike story. And once we solve that problem, then we'll figure out where that might enable us to go. But that's very different than the top-down, gee, if I could sell a Coke to 1% of the kids in China, I'll be rich. Mm. No, it's just a completely different mindset. And that's why I call these mindsets counter-conventional, John. Yeah. They run counter to the conventional way of thinking. Yeah.
So the fourth rule is ask for the cash, ride the float. And this is where you're talking about entrepreneurs being able to do things without almost any money.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell
which
us
is nirvana
that.
For entrepreneurs, right?
Yeah.
You know, again, the conventional thinking is that your first port of call has to be at an angel or a venture capital to get some money to start what you do. But when Elon Musk and his partners started Tesla, they did something very interesting. They said, well, First of all, their overall vision for the business was to make the automotive world turn electric, right? Because of all the environmental issues. And they said, the way we're going to do that is we're going to build a really fancy, expensive car, and we're going to use the profits from that venture to kind of move downscale, and then we'll build a little bit cheaper car, and then eventually we'll get to an even cheaper car that can be used by the masses. So to build that first expensive car, they said, okay, let's do a little roadshow in California. They were all in California. And let's get people in a room who have three characteristics. Number one, they're wealthy. Number two, they're environmentally conscious. And number three, they like fast cars. And if we can get a bunch of people in a room who share those characteristics, we're going to tell them, we're going to build this car. It's called a Tesla Roadster, and we'd like you to buy one. And if you'd like one, we're going to build 100 of them, and you can buy it now, but you have to pay us today, and the price is $100,000. Well, do the math. They sold 100 cars in 3 weeks for $100,000 a pop. That's $10 million with which to get started on building the first Roadster. And that principle has then continued throughout the Tesla journey. So there's this perception that Tesla is a venture capital backed business, and it is, although most of the capital came from Musk himself. But the key actually is the capital efficiency, because each time they introduce a new car, they say, okay, we're going to introduce the Model X or whatever it is, now the Model 3. And it's going to be ready soon. And if you want one, get on the list, and you have to put a deposit down. Well, for the Model 3, interestingly, 500,000 people put a deposit down, almost 500,000 people, at $1,000 a piece. That's $500 million with which to start, you know, designing the car, build the tooling, all the stuff you have to do to get the first car to roll off the assembly line. So what Tesla has really built by asking for the cash up front and then using that cash to do all the other things you have to do, they built a customer-funded growth machine. It's back to my earlier book, but it's a mindset that Musk has. You just always ask the customer to pay before you give them what you're going to build for them. Mm.
So that is deeply counter-convention. And counterintuitive as well, that customers are prepared to pay for that. And in order to be able to create the pull, you have to be giving people something they truly believe they want.
You do.
You can't exactly get them to do that for an innovation on Tide, can you?
You probably can't do that on Tide. But you know, Michael Dell did it years ago with PCs, right? He was a college student working out of his dorm room, And he asked people to pay for the computer. Well, it wasn't a consumer business at the time. It was, you know, lawyers and small businesses and people like that. I'll build you exactly the computer you need that'll do exactly what you want done. I won't speak the language of computer stores, which nobody could understand. And I'll do that for you. And if you want one, pay me today, and in a couple of weeks I'll have the computer for you. So this goes back a long, long time.
Have you had any experience in helping or persuading your clients to adopt that principle in a otherwise conservative environment?
Yes, lots of it, of two kinds. One kind is, holy cow, John, I'm going to use that now as a screening device for opportunities I screen for new ventures, and I'm not going to start something new unless it's customer fundable. That's one response I get. So I have a lot of people come to MBA programs today explicitly to start a new business. That's why they come to business school. They're going to find money. They're going to find an idea. They're going to find a partner and so on. So quite often I get the response, fantastic. I'm going to screen ideas, and I would rather not have to bother with investors. I'd rather focus on customers. So I'm going to screen my ideas until I find one that I can customer fund. That's one response I get. The other one I get is, well, gee, I'm in a very competitive business. None of my competitors make their customer pay in advance. So how can I get my customer to pay in advance? I can't. And my answer to them is, well, you have a problem. You're in a commodity business. You need to get out of that commodity business and get into one where you're offering something that's different. And that's different enough and compelling enough that the customer wants to rip it out of your hands. And if you find that, the customer will pay you in advance. And until you find that, you're going to be under severe margin pressure and you're not going to have a lot of fun. So those are the two responses I get. It's bipolar.
So your fifth mindset, beg, borrow, but don't steal. Tell us about why this is important.
Well, we know for any startup, but also for anything new that a larger, more established company wants to do, we know there's a lot of uncertainty in the new idea. We think we found something that customers want and need, but we might not be right. We might not have the product just right or the service just right. So we don't know if it's going to work, really, if we're honest with ourselves. Big companies say, well, let's figure out how much we have to invest, and let's figure out what the cash flows are going to be in the future, and we'll run some numbers in it, and if it's worthwhile to make that investment in terms of the return on that investment we can get, then we'll start that thing. Entrepreneurs do it differently. They say, I'm not sure I want to invest because I don't know if it's going to work. Why would I invest if it might not work? So when we started Pastavia, we needed to make fresh pasta and sauces for the pasta that people would come to our wonderful little stores and take home and have a really fast and healthy dinner. That's back when fresh pasta was seen to be good, you know, carbo-loading and all of that. It's gone through times when pasta's bad for you, but pasta was good for you in those days. And so we said, well, we need a commercial kitchen where we can make our products. But we don't need to build one yet because we don't really know how this is going to work. So let's see if we can find a commercial kitchen that's not busy part of the day and see if we can borrow it. So that's what we did. We found a commercial kitchen and a gourmet food store that we could move our pasta machine into and that had all the other things we needed to make sauces and so on. And that's where we operated for the first year and a half. And only after we had proven that we had customer demand did we then say, okay, now it's time to build our own commercial kitchen and go forward. And so this is what good entrepreneurs do. They don't invest up front. They borrow the resources they need. One of the stories I tell in the book is about a very big company that did this in India. There's a company called Bharti Airtel. It's one of the biggest cell phone operators in the world today. But in the early days in India, when India opened up to mobile telephones, Bharti and the others won licenses in all the urban markets, one after the other, right? Because that's where they thought the demand was going to be best. And Bharti was a leader, but they realized that the next phase of their growth was going to have to be in rural markets because the urban markets had been opened by them and others. And they said, this is going to be a tough nut to crack because A, the rural customer doesn't have the buying power to pay very high rates, and B, the rural customer is not likely to use as many minutes of cell phone time as the urban customer is. So how on earth are we going to make money? And they said, well, we need to become asset light. So they went to their key suppliers, Ericsson being one of them, and said to Ericsson, we don't want you to keep selling us equipment. We want you to own all the network equipment and operate it for us, and we will pay you as customers use it. They did the same thing with their software. There's lots of software involved in a mobile telephone business. And they went to IBM and said, we want to offload all of our IT work to you. And you do all the work. And again, we'll pay you as the customers use the system. And then they offloaded all the cell phone towers as well to a joint venture with some others. So all of a sudden they had no assets they had to worry about. And they could lower their pricing sharply and get paid in advance because it was a prepaid scratch card system. And they revolutionized the cell phone business by just getting all the assets off the balance sheet. Well, that was done in a big company. So to the question you raised earlier, this doesn't have to be done only in startups, right? Mm-hmm. All of these mindsets apply anywhere else. And they became the biggest cell phone carrier in India and then Africa. And today they're one of the biggest cell phone operators in the world because they said, well, we don't need all those assets on our balance sheet. Mm-hmm. Simple and counterintuitive and counterconventional.
Hi, this is Emma Sinclair, business psychologist, occasional co-host, and fan of the Evolving Leader podcast. Did you know that we also have an Evolving Leader YouTube channel, where we upload snippets from many of the podcast episodes? It's a visual feast of leadership goodness. Just go to YouTube, search for the Evolving Leader, subscribe, like, and comment. Now, back to the conversation.
And finally, we have, instead of asking for permission, beg for forgiveness. What convention is this breaking?
Well, in big companies, there's an army of lawyers, right? And the job of those lawyers is to make sure nobody goes to jail, especially the top execs, and that nobody does anything that's going to get somebody in trouble. That's their main job. So when you want to do something new, especially in our digital age here, where the digitization of all these industries makes it possible to do things in radically new ways, that the existing regulatory systems haven't contemplated, right? The shining example is Uber, right? They said, well, you know, let's build a different kind of urban transportation system here. We're not going to own any cars. We're just going to find people who have cars, and we're going to connect them with people who want rides, and we're going to call it Uber Cab. And they started in San Francisco. Did they go to the regulators and say, "Gee, we'd like to do this. Would you give us a license to start Uber Cab?" They did not. Had they done so, my guess is Uber would not exist today, nor would Grab or Careem or all its copycat imitators around the world, and maybe even the gig economy wouldn't be the same as it is today. Who knows? And it was interesting, you know, the regulators were clearly not happy as Uber began to grow fast. Consumers loved it, and Uber grew very fast, and the taxi industry was really concerned. And not happy, and the regulators weren't happy, and they told them to make a bunch of changes and some things they had to do. And the only change they made is they took cab out of the name, so it became Uber instead of Uber Cab, And they continue to do this in city after city after city. Don't ask permission, just enter, build a business, get a whole bunch of customers to love you. And then when the regulators want to shut you down, the customers go, you can't shut Uber down. We love Uber. We need Uber. It's an important part of our life here. So, you know, entrepreneurs do this all the time. It's become sort of a mantra in entrepreneurship. Never ask permission. Beg forgiveness later if you have to.
You could argue you have less to lose when you're in that position of establishing it. How do you balance? Because this is all a set of trade-offs and balances, isn't it, between risk and opportunity? And again, how have you seen that principle within a corporate being handled well?
Well, you know, I talk to people. I have lots of students who work in big companies, of course, alumni. And what they tell me is when you want to do something new in a big company, there are lots of people who can say no. No, you can't do it for this reason. You can't do it for that reason. It's really hard to get to yes. And yes may never come. And if it comes, it probably won't come very fast. So that's kind of the big company setting where you want to do something that's truly new. Could Marriott have started something like Airbnb? Of course they could have, but they didn't. Could some taxi company or somebody already in the transportation business have started Uber? They could have, but they didn't. You know, the big companies just don't do radically new things very easily. It's very difficult for them to do so. And that's why entrepreneurs are the ones who you know, break these seeming conventional rules and get the big new things done. And note, it's really important to note here, John, I'm not saying break the law.
No.
I'm not saying break the law. There wasn't a law that said you couldn't do what Uber did. There were laws about regulating taxi cab companies who own taxis. Don't break those laws, you know. But if the law is ambiguous, there's another story in the book about a wonderful company called Team Lease in India that is today among the biggest temporary help businesses in India. And at the time they started in 2003, there's a thicket of labor laws in India, both at the federal and state level. And they basically said, you know, in order to comply with 100% of the laws, we're going to have to break 20% of them because the laws were in conflict with one another, the local ones and even some of the federal laws. And they said, you know, we need to put India to work. India needed jobs. Temporary help could be a wonderful entree into the work world for lots of Indians. We just need to do this business. And yeah, we're going to maybe break some laws, but those are unjust laws that fly in the face of other laws. You know, you can't comply with them all at the same time. So they said, we're going to start this. And they took the high road, interestingly. They were very public about it. They did an Indian labor report every year. They organized conferences around labor reform. And they weren't sneaking under the table. They were being very public about it. Said India needs to change. We need to put Indians to work, and they built a fabulous business.
So you conclude the book by pointing out that not every entrepreneur displays all of these mindsets. But Linda Weinman, who the founder of Lynda.com, seems exceptional. She seems to display. I don't know if she displays all of them, but can you tell us a little bit about her story?
Yeah, so Linda is what I call an intuitively counter-conventional entrepreneur. So she was a teacher in Pasadena teaching graphic design when Photoshop and Illustrator were created. And all of a sudden it was possible to do graphic design digitally instead of with pen and paper for the first time. And she said, I need to teach my students these tools. And so she went looking in the bookstore to see if she could find a book on how to use these tools. And there was no book. And she said, well, I better write the book. So she said, I'll write a proposal. She wrote a proposal, sent it off to a couple publishers, and nobody would publish it. So she said, "Okay, I'll get a magazine to do it as a monthly serial." So the chapters in the book became published that way. So she didn't take no. And then over the course of her journey, she kept running into no's. And each time she ran into a no, she didn't accept the no. Finally, she got a book done, and it became the number one book in the world in graphic design. And she wanted to do a couple of more titles. And the book publisher didn't want to do them. So she said, "Okay, we'll put them on VHS cassettes, and we'll start offering courses." And then she started doing speaking gigs around the world because her book was so famous. And eventually, she and her husband said, "Well, we don't have to live where we're living in urban Northern California. Why don't we move to Ojai, California, on the beach north of Los Angeles? It's an idyllic resort community." So they moved. And her husband, Bruce, one day said, "You know, you're flying all over the place. Why do you have to fly to Peoria, Illinois to do a talk on graphic design? Why don't we get the customers to fly to Ojai? Let's run our courses here." And again, she couldn't find a place to do it. So it was looking like another no. But then she said, wait a second. There's a computer lab in the local high school. I wonder if they'd let us use the computer lab on spring break. Well, that's what she did. She turned that no into a yes. So Linda has turned all these no's into yeses over the course of her career. And that's how I came into knowledge of her story. But it turns out she also exemplifies all these other mindsets, but she didn't know she was breaking any rules. She's just a teacher, and her husband's an artist. They just intuitively went down the road saying, "Yes, we can." When somebody, you know, when there was a need for something, they'd say, "Yeah, we can do that." She was asked by William Shatner of Star Wars fame to do the digital rendering of the Starship Enterprise for the very first Starship movie. He said, "Can you do that, Linda?" And she said, "Yeah, I can do that." And then it was, "Holy cow, how the hell am I going to do that?" She'd never done it before, but she figured it out. So yes, we can. And she was problem first, not product first. So she focused on students learning. That's all she cared about. And whatever medium it was required to deliver that learning, whether that was VHS tapes or in-person seminars or eventually online, that's what she did. She thought narrowly about her target market. So when she got started, her target market was Mac users, because that's where the software worked in the early days. And Mac had a low single-digit market share, so she wasn't going after some huge market. It was just Mac users and the subset of those Mac users who wanted to do graphic design. So tiny target market. But of course, when she learned how to deliver hands-on training to use these digital tools, and the number of digital tools proliferated, those skills grew and grew and grew, and the product line grew and grew. She always asked for the cash up front. So whether it was a book, getting an advance, or an in-person course that you booked, you know, before you showed up for the course, or eventually online stuff that you bought on subscription for $25 a month, and you know, you could access all the videos you wanted. All of those things, and then borrowing the asset of the computer classroom at the high school in Ojai. I mean, she's kind of the poster child for all this. Did she know she was breaking rules? No, she didn't. It was just intuitive in her case. This is how I need to build my business. The only one of them that I think she doesn't exemplify is the notion of asking for permission. There wasn't anything regulatory-wise that she had to kind of worry about. So in 2006, they began selling their training online, and they decided to get rid of all the other product lines and just focus on online. In 2007, they hired a CEO who brought to the party some some experience in tech and internet marketing. A long story short, in 2015, LinkedIn knocked on their door and said, "We'd like to buy your company." Wow. At that time, they had 83,000 videos on the site, and you could access any of those videos for, I think the price had gone up to 30 or 35 a month. LinkedIn said, "We want to buy you because we want to transition our business from how to get a job to how to train you to get that new job you want." And so they paid $1.5 billion for Lynda.com.
Wow.
Nice ending.
Yeah.
For a school teacher and an artist to have created.
Well, folks, it's time to break the rules. So order your copy of Break the Rules today. And John, thank you so much for coming on and sharing a bit about your research and your work. And it's just been a real pleasure, really educational.
Yeah. Thank you, John.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure to be here.
And folks, until next time, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?